Get informed no matter where you are or what you're doing. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now and get news when you want it on your schedule.
Big tech dominating our headlines.
Another win for Donald Trump.
A key inflation report.
These are short audio reports, 5 minutes or less, that bring you the latest headlines with context 24 hours a day. Stay on top of the latest news from around the world. Get it on your smartphone. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen.
Japan's double-digit demographics and aging population, that's also shrinking. That puts pressure on the workforce.
But even older folks who want to work often can't get jobs.
It was very hard to find work at the public job centers because all the jobs has an age cap.
Today on The World, how Japan is dealing with its workforce problems.
Also, Tokyo's intricate web of public transit keeps cars off the road.
Plus, women stepping into the sumo ring.
I'm exuding some kind of aura that I'm going to fight. And afterwards, my opponent will say that you looked bigger in the ring.
And the global appeal of Hello Kitty.
We all need a little cuteness, you know, in our lives. It's like, aw, she's adorable.
Have you caught on to the theme? We're all about Japan ahead this hour on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for being here today. People in Japan are looking at two big trade stories today, fish and cars.
Let's start with good news for the country's fishing industry. China has officially opened its markets to seafood from Japan after a nearly two-year ban. That ban was implemented after a wastewater release from the destroyed Fukushima nuclear power plant. That sparked concerns in Beijing about seafood sourced from slightly radioactive wastewater. As of today, the ban is mostly lifted. China will still not import seafood from areas closest to Fukushima.
5月28日、日中双方は日本産水産物の対中輸出再開に必要な技術的要件について合意し、
That's Japan's Agriculture Minister Shinjiro Koizumi calling the move a major turning point for Japan.
輸入解禁に関する報告を発出いたしました。我が国にとって
That other trade story, cars, hasn't had the same breakthrough. The U.S. and Japan are still not settled on tariffs over automobiles. Speaking yesterday on Fox, President Trump took an aggressive stance. He said that as with other countries subject to his tariffs, he plans to send a letter demanding that Japan play ball with the U.S. or else.
Here's the story. You're going to pay a 25% tariff on your cars, you know. So we give Japan no cars. They won't take our cars, right? And yet we take millions and millions of their cars into the United States. It's not fair.
The auto industry is a key sector in Japan's economy.
These trade issues all sit against the backdrop of serious demographic challenges. Although this will bear out in upcoming elections in Japan, a year after the longtime ruling party lost its parliamentary majority for the first time in 15 years. With so much happening with an important strategic ally of the U.S., we're dedicating today's show to Japan. The people, culture, and history that are making it, by the way, a top tourist destination as well.
Of all the challenges facing Japan right now, demographics are a top concern. The overall population is declining and aging. That means Japan's workforce is shrinking. But it is not always up to employees whether to keep working into their later years, because many companies set a mandatory retirement age. Last year, I was in Japan and reported on the impact that has on workers and wages. A recruiter from a building services company in Tokyo is touting the benefits of cleaning jobs she's hiring for at a job fair for people over age 55. There's no age limit for the job, she says, and the work, sweeping, vacuuming, taking out the trash, it's not too hard. The companies recruiting here are all looking for cleaners or people to direct traffic. Many of the job seekers who come here are white-collar workers who've aged out of their lifelong careers. Most Japanese companies have a mandatory retirement age, usually 60. This applies to Masanori Masumoto. He's wearing a pinstriped button-down and holds a resume in a plastic folder as he talks to me and my interpreter.
I was working in the defense ministry for 35 years.
He, like many others, retired at 60.
なんて言ったらいいのかな。
He says he's here interviewing for janitorial jobs.
なんか事務的な仕事を探してるんですけど、
He'd prefer to find an office job again, something more similar to his work at the defense ministry. But he says companies want young people for those jobs.
And this is driven by the fact that wages are driven by seniority.
Randall Jones is the former head of the Japan desk at the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Jones says in Japan's seniority-based pay system, workers start out not making much money, but wages rise relatively quickly.
And at some point, the wage gets higher than your productivity, so the mandatory retirement allows them to let people go.
After they hit retirement age, people often end up at smaller companies that employ lower-skilled workers, which typically don't pay based on seniority. Like Yokobi Key Shutters in Tokyo, where more than a third of the 32 employees are over age 65. On the manufacturing floor, workers weld and use metal presses to make shutter components.
なんで高齢者がダメなのかっていう理由がわからない。
Company president Shinjiro Ichikawa tells me he doesn't understand why other people say older workers aren't good. For him, if his employees help make a profit, work well together, and he's happy with them,
年齢とか国籍とか性別とか障害は一切関係ないでしょ。
Then age, sex, and nationality are nothing to be concerned about, he says.
英語しか喋れないんで、僕は喋れないですけど。
Upstairs in the office, 82-year-old Kanai Nobuharu is designing shutters using modeling software on his computer. He retired in his mid-70s, he tells me, through an interpreter. But a few years later, he needed money to pay for his wife's cancer treatment.
非常に大変。で、日本ではハローワークっていうところに就職を探しに行くんですけど、
It was very hard to find work at the public job centers because all the jobs has an age cap, so I couldn't find a job.
He saw a TV story about this company and applied. He's a licensed architect and used to design nuclear power plants. Designing metal shutters is less technical work, and he took a significant pay cut.
どうですかね。やっぱり半分ぐらい違うんじゃないですか。
Maybe I'm receiving half of what I received at the age of 60.
Does that seem fair to you?
そうですね。
He nods a yes.
Yes, I wouldn't demand that high amount because I'm already lucky that I've got a job this age.
Japan is trying to expand its workforce, and Randall Jones, formerly of the OECD, says effectively employing seniors could help.
The work-age population has been falling for quite some time now, and so there is a tension where companies are short of workers.
Jones argued in a recent report for the OECD that the mandatory retirement age should be abolished.
What we have to do is break down the seniority-based wage system so that people are paid more on their productivity, their capacity, their performance, and not by some arbitrary requirement of how long they've been alive.
Jones says Japan's government does not seem to favor this move, and there's not much pressure from workers either, who see their job security as linked to a mandatory retirement age. The government has, however, recently passed measures meant to encourage companies to keep workers on the job until age 70. The presentations at the Tokyo Job Center are over now, and job seekers are interviewing with recruiters one-on-one. But typically, very few of these interviews yield a match. If you don't mind cleaning or directing traffic, then it's easy to get a job, says the Career Center's manager, Hiroi Takatoshi. But there's a gap between what kinds of jobs job seekers want and what kinds of job opportunities are available. Last fiscal year, Takatoshi tells me more than 1,800 job seekers over age 55 passed through here. 128 landed jobs.
Carolyn reporting from Tokyo last summer. In most megacities, traffic is a mega problem. So is air pollution. But Tokyo, with a population of 37 million people, bucks that trend thanks to a massive web of public transit that keeps cars off the road. Many countries look to Tokyo as a success story. But as we hear from the world's Jeremy Siegel, Tokyo is unique and may not serve as the best model for other parts of the globe.
It might sound weird, but the first thing you hear when arriving at Tokyo's Ebisu Station is the theme from the 1940s noir film, The Third Man. Every train stop here has a theme. subtly and efficiently letting people know where they are and when to get off. It's emblematic of the unique culture of transit in this densely populated city. So dense, according to Tomohiko Taniguchi, that every little way you can make things run more smoothly counts. Like the songs, having train employees literally stuff passengers in during rush hour, and a unique set of unspoken rules for how passengers should act.
In Japan, one of the things that you might have noticed is that people are dead silent in very much busy trains and crowded trains. And it is to make annoyance as little as possible.
Taniguchi, who used to be a rail executive and an advisor to former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, has been taking the train his whole life. Here in Tokyo, he tells me, as thousands of riders pass us by on a busy platform, life revolves around rail stations.
And on Saturdays and Sundays, teenagers meet at the stations to see their, you know, friends, girlfriends and boyfriends. A cute love affair will pop up around these busy train stations.
The busiest train station of all, with 3.5 million people passing through every day, is Shinjuku Station. That's where I bump into Hari, who only gave me her first name. Hari hasn't found romance at a train station herself, but she does love Japanese transit, and tells me that she always chooses to take the train because it's more convenient. She can drive, but hasn't once since moving to Tokyo. Hari's perspective is nothing out of the ordinary in Tokyo, where the vast majority of people don't drive but use trains. It is, however, unique globally. More than 50% of commutes around the world are made by car. Obviously, that's no fun when you're stuck in gridlock trying to get to work, the grocery store, or to visit family. So how did Tokyo avoid this problem? The former rail exec Tomohiko Taniguchi says it's simple.
In the United States, you get car culture, but Tokyo is a densely populated city.
A city that Fumihiro Araki tells me developed its own transit culture. Araki is deputy director of the Railway Museum, a massive structure north of Tokyo that serves as a tribute to Japan's rich history of transit. He tells me that in the late 1800s, as the country transitioned to a democracy, leaders began building railways to keep up with Western countries. And then, as the country was rebuilding after the Second World War, Japan, unlike the U.S., which was throwing money at highways, doubled down on trains, making massive investments in transit infrastructure, which coincided with a major population boom in Tokyo. Today, there are nearly three dozen private operators of more than 100 different train lines. The maps are incredibly confusing, but make clear there's almost nowhere in the city that doesn't have a train station.
In other countries, railway is railway. The station is just a place of riding on a train.
Shunzo Miyaki heads up international affairs at the country's largest railway company, JR East. He tells me that he's visited 40 different countries. And what's happened here is entirely unique. Every rail operator competes for passenger traffic, developing real estate around stations to turn them into economic hubs, places where people want to stay after they get off the train.
So, for example, we run a retail business. Food and beverage business, shopping centers, hotels, real estate, etc.
Miyake says developing Tokyo's system and ingraining transit into the city's culture has taken time and money. For them, it's paid off. But Tokyo's system grew with its population, and superimposing that on megacities that don't have the luxury of time and money, that might just be a mega dream. For the world, I'm Jeremy Siegel, Tokyo.
Japan, from modern transportation to cultural legacy. Just ahead, how a recent earthquake there threatened the sustainability of a revered craft tradition. You're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor here at The World. While I may not be a familiar voice, I've been deeply committed to our work here at The World for years, helping to share the exceptional global journalism you know and love. Since our launch in 1996, The World has weathered many storms, and we remain committed to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. But we are in unprecedented times, and never has the threat to public media been greater than right now because of the efforts to withdraw all federal funding. This puts greater pressure on our newsroom and our journalists. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We're powered by listeners like you. And right now, we need your help. Even if you've never given before, perhaps today is the day. We are in our spring fundraising drive, and a generous donor has offered a 2-to-1 match, tripling your impact between now and June 30th. That means if you donate $25, we receive $75. Your $100 equals to another $300. If you've given in the past, please consider renewing your gift or increasing your monthly contribution, if only by a small amount. Every gift, no matter how small, truly makes a difference. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We're spending this hour exploring news and culture from Japan. When a major earthquake rocked Ishikawa Prefecture last year, one of the hardest hit towns was Wajima.
It's in a region of the country that's known for the traditional craft of lacquer and a particular style of lacquerware called Wajima Nuri. After that earthquake, residents fled Ishikawa and the artisans who made the lacquerware dispersed. That displacement put livelihoods in peril, not to mention the region's identity. Hannah Kirshner reported on the aftermath from the town of Yamanaka.
Rabia Gebler touches a blade to a fast-spinning piece of wood on a lathe. Shavings fly off in ribbons, and the wood takes the shape of a bowl, the kind used for miso soup. Gibler is German and came to Yamanaka about 2 years ago to study the town's specific style of wood turning.
It's in the mountains. Yamanaka means in the middle of the mountains, so there's a lot of wood.
For hundreds of years, Yamanaka artisans have been turning that wood into tableware and teaware. Sometimes the wood turners apply a finish themselves, but often their products become a canvas for artisans from Wajima, north of here on the Noto Peninsula. In Wajima, lacquer specialists apply urushi, which is lacquer made from the sap of urushi trees. Making one piece of Wajima nuri can take 5 craftspeople and more than 100 steps.
So you'll have someone making the base material, you'll have someone doing the base coats, the middle coats and the top coats, and then even a person for the sanding in between.
Wow. Yeah. The result is a shiny, opaque lacquer, usually black or red. And then on top of that, sometimes another craftsperson will apply makie. Makie is this painstaking process of painting detailed illustrations with urushi and sprinkling gold powder onto the design. Tiny bits of pearlescent shell or iridescent insect wings are used too. Imagine making a mosaic from individual pieces of glitter. Ayano Konishi is a makie artist who had her studio in Wajima until the earthquake. Her studio was attached to a family lacquerware shop that had been in business for about 250 years. The shop was on the same street as Wajima's famous morning market, where vendors sell fish and produce. And all along that street are lacquerware shops and studios. On December 31st, as usual, our shop was open, Konishi tells me. I took my children for a walk, and we went to the vegetable auntie to buy mandarin oranges and fruits. Everyone greeted us, and the children had a lot of fun. But on New Year's Day, everything would change in Wajima. Konishi and her family were relaxing at their apartment just outside of town. There was a tremendous shaking. I really thought the apartment was going to collapse. I really thought we would die, says Konishi. Aftershocks kept coming, and in downtown Wajima, a fire broke out. The earthquake caused the ground to rise, so there was no water anywhere, says Konishi. Pipes broke, and the river and fire cisterns drained, so firefighters couldn't draw water. Wajima's morning market and all the lacquerware shops and studios around it burned. 6 months later, much of Wajima is still uninhabitable. Craftspeople have scattered around the country, going to stay with relatives or in temporary housing. Some Wajima craftspeople have given up, especially the older ones. But one couple in their 70s tells me they are determined to continue. Kazuya and Kasumi Shirota are both makie artisans like Konishi. After the earthquake, their son urged them to come stay with him in Hyogo Prefecture, far away. I thought, I'm already old, so if I go to my son's place, I'll become senile, says Kazuya Shirota. Kasumi wanted to continue doing makie too. A lacquerware craftsman called them from Yamanaka Onsen, the wood-turning town. He invited them to come right away and promised to help them start working again. I meet the Shirotas at the apartment complex where they now live in Yamanaka, and we sit around the table where they work. Kazuya Shirota makes these incredibly ornate designs on ceremonial objects, things to be used in Buddhist temples or during tea ceremony. He shows me an incense box decorated with a hen and a rooster.
I just can't get over how detailed and lifelike the chickens are on this incense box.
Their feathers were painted one by one, textured with tiny lines.
There's like 7 different sizes of gold flakes on this.
The Shirotas tell me they wish they could return to Wajima. They can get money from the government to tear down their damaged house, but they would have to rebuild at their own expense. It could take years. At 70, they don't think it's realistic. As for Ayano Konishi, who had her studio near Wajima's morning market, she also ended up in Yamanaka, just a few doors down in the same apartment complex. When I visit, she still hasn't set up her workspace, so we sit around the kitchen table. Her older son is home from preschool with a fever. He sits in her lap with a juice box while she shows me how she sprinkles gold powder by flicking a small bamboo tube with a mesh end. Tools are often passed down from parent to child or teacher to student. Some of these tools you can no longer buy. Konishi explains that even when she bought tools, she modified them to suit her. She lost so many tools in the fire, and she wishes she could get them back. There's been an outpouring of support for Wajima artisans. Craftspeople from all over Japan have sent tools. Crowdfunding campaigns received donations from around the world. Because of all that attention, the Wajima artisans who can work are busier than ever. And in turn, Yamanaka woodturners are busy making wooden bases for them. We are aiming to return to Wajima eventually, Konishi says. But it will take years to clear the rubble and rebuild. For as long as she lives in Yamanaka, she wants to get inspiration from her new environment. Her work draws from nature and is also influenced by the people she collaborates with. She recently ordered some wooden bases from a craftsman she met here in Yamanaka. Earthquakes are part of life in Japan, and the crafts we see as traditional now were shaped by historic events, by natural resources, and the movement of people. If more Wajima artisans start working in Yamanaka, these two towns and their crafts may become even more interconnected. Some craftspeople are hopeful that will strengthen both traditions, and they will continue to evolve. For the world, I'm Hannah Kirshner, Yamanaka.
This hour, we're all about Japan. We've talked demographics, Road Tokyo's exceptional transit network, and you know what else Japan is known for?
Sports! Coming up, the country most famous for sumo wrestling finally gets women into the ring. Plus, who's not a fan of Hello Kitty? More to come. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
She comes from a wonderful world of fantasy. It's Hello Kitty!
The iconic character Hello Kitty was born in Japan, but her popularity is global and has lasted generations. Last fall, when Hello Kitty turned 50, we spoke with Leslie Bow, a professor of English and Asian American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
So her origin story really began with stationery. She was a mascot for these stationery store started by Sanrio. You know, she was just a figure that made these items more appealing and attractive to especially young girls and women.
Right. As you say, she was created basically just as a design. Her backstory was only added later after she was already popular, right?
Right. So technically, she is not a cat. She's a girl. She's English. Her name is Kitty White, and she lives in London.
Somewhat recently, the first creator of Hello Kitty, Shimizu Yuko, said to the BBC that she was a little girl and not a cat. And fans kind of freaked out about that.
Yes, there was a huge reaction to that. And to me, you know, cat or girl, you know, she still reflects this kind of cute style. You know, the marketability is about a specific kind of appeal. You know, like, why are these, you know, like little cute things? So they're little, they're cute, they have a very rounded shape, they have a very minimalist cartooning style. So not a whole lot of lines, no shading whatsoever. And they really are to stimulate this idea of, oh, they look like babies. They need to be taken care of. They stimulate, you know, the kind of protective feelings. And I think that that is the essence of not just Hello Kitty, but a lot of these characters who came after her as well.
You've mentioned the word kawaii a few times, which roughly translates to what, cuteness, but it is this whole aesthetic in Japan. Can you tell me more about that?
Actually started as a kind of populist movement among, 14-year-old or so Japanese girls who had affected this kind of loopy, rounded style of writing that was called kanekoji or kitten style. And then, you know, it kind of spread into a corporate, you know, movement. And now you see it all over Japan.
So never underestimate the power of the teenage girl, I guess.
Absolutely. I mean, I think what's most fascinating to me is when you read about the history of cute style, you know, it wasn't a corporate movement. You know, it was a movement that girls in Japan were actually creating for themselves, right? Creating, you know, a sense of difference or a sense of something that was their own. The irony of that there are really gendered formations, right, that go into the consumption of cute goods. And certainly one of those, in terms of her theory, is that these girls did not want to grow up, right? So that actually the consumption of things that are associated with childhood constituted a resistance to taking on the more defined and responsible and circumscribed roles of women in Japan.
You've touched on this throughout this conversation, but there have been countless characters and cartoons created since Hello Kitty was born 50 years ago. Why does she remain so very popular? What is it about her that is so enduring?
You can have lots of academic, you know, conversations about that, right? And at another level, it's like, oh, come on.
She's so cute.
She is so cute. The bow. And of course, my last name being bow, I like gravitate towards that one. So I can intellectualize all this stuff about kawaii. But at the end of the day, I think my desire towards that is the same as yours. It's like, oh, she's adorable.
That's Leslie Bow, professor of English and Asian American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
One of the hottest trends in Japanese music is actually a low-tech embrace of nostalgia. The World's Matthew Bell takes us to Tokyo's listening lounges. When you step inside Bar Martha, an unsmiling host is quick to point out the rules. Keep your voice down, no photos, and we have a cover charge. The management at Bar Martha has no interest in speaking to a foreign reporter. They don't take reservations here. They also do not want you posting stuff about the place on social media. Remember rule number two, no photos? Smoking is fine, though. Conversation is allowed, but discouraged. Once you've settled into your seat, though, and there's a well-crafted cocktail in front of you, it's easy to hear what the attraction is. The listening lounge experience is about basking in the unique sound of vinyl being played on a vintage stereo system. I read that the old tube amplifiers and gigantic antique speakers here cost well into the six figures. Oh, and there's another rule. No requests. These DJs will be picking records from their own playlists. Thank you very much.
Nice to go to bars where you can just sit quietly.
I catch Duncan Turner and a friend who are visiting Tokyo on their way out. This is their first listening bar experience. And they're way into it, despite the semi-strict rules.
You really rarely just sit and listen to music, especially analog music. Yeah. You know, vinyl records through a really impressive sound system, and you do have a kind of new appreciation of it.
Shuya Okino has been in the music business for more than 30 years. He owns a nightclub in Tokyo and wears shades indoors. I asked him for a little history lesson on Japan's original listening lounges.
We call it jazz kissa.
Jazz cafes became a thing in the 1950s after the Korean War, when American military personnel passed through Japan and brought jazz records with them. Okino says a big moment was in 1961 when Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers played here.
So TV, radio introduced Art Blakey as a symbol of modern jazz.
The music became hugely popular, but vinyl records were prohibitively expensive for most people. In recent years, listening lounges have opened up all over Japan. Shuya Okino says they're sort of a revival of those original jazz kisses. And he reckons there's another reason why decidedly low-key listening lounges are so hot right now. This younger generation, he says, has a different approach toward nightlife.
When I was young, drinking, talking, dancing till morning. But they are, I don't want to say square. I don't know right words. They want to enjoy Sunday holiday. So they want to go home earlier, go to bed, wake up early.
Maybe this is more mature.
Yeah, I think so. They are young, but they are more mature thinking.
Some listening lounges are much less strict than others. 57-year-old Nobuo Miyamae has been spinning records at the Little Soul Cafe for more than 20 years. Mia, as he's known, says he was first inspired by hip-hop as a teenager, and later funk, soul, and R&B, all of which he plays for his patrons. And if they feel like having a conversation at his place, he's totally fine with that. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, Tokyo.
The rules of sumo wrestling are pretty straightforward. You square off with an opponent in a wide ring, then try to push the other person out of the circle. Another thing about Japanese professional sumo, no women are allowed. But as The World's Patrick Nguyen reported last year from Tokyo, some women are fighting to get into the sport.
Sumo champ Ishii Sakura is breathing hard. She's just finished trouncing a competitor, a guy. Now she's about to fight him all over again. Ishii re-enters the ring and hits him with a death stare. There's no rage in her eyes. She's just looking at him the way sharks look at food. The match is about to commence.
Okay.
The guy jams his hand in Ishii's armpit to flip her, but she hits him like a bulldozer, sends him flying right out of the ring. That's his back hitting the wooden wall of the dojo. This is just practice against a teammate. In real matches, women only face off against other women. 18-year-old Ishii Sakura competes for Rikkyo University, which has a legendary sumo team. But she is the only woman on the team. Between matches, I ask, through an interpreter, behind that cold stare, what are you thinking?
I'm exuding some kind of aura that I'm going to fight. And afterwards, my opponent will say that you looked bigger in the ring.
Ishii is 5'3". She's a light middleweight, meaning when she competes, her weight can't be over 80 kilos, about 176 pounds. She does try to stay as close to the limit as possible. Every pound adds more power. Ishii works out heavy, barbell squats, leg presses, turning her legs and core into iron. Beyond being really strong, Ishii tells me there is another big perk to doing sumo, breakfast. I get to start my day with ramen, she says, and fried chicken. Outside the ring, Ishii Sakura is not intimidating. She's funny and very chill. Around campus, she wears old t-shirts borrowed from her dad, who puts up wallpaper for a living. Ishii is also a big fan of Japanese comics and horror movies. She doesn't seem to have a huge ego. When Ishii meets someone new, she often won't mention that she's one of Japan's top female sumo wrestlers. Because in Japan, people find the idea of women in sumo kind of strange. They ask embarrassing questions, like,
do you do it naked? Because boys do it without their clothes on. They also say, oh, how can you do sumo with boys?
Ishii does wear a shirt and gym shorts in the ring, in addition to her loincloth. Men only wear a loincloth. And while Ishii is not widely known in Japan, sumo is actually bigger than Japan. Women's sumo now has a niche following in Russia, Poland, Brazil, and parts of the U.S. Ishii made her mark at the 2022 World Games, a tournament for sports that haven't made it into the Olympics.
Once again, this is for the women's middleweight gold medal.
Ishii, in a black t-shirt and black loincloth, faced a Ukrainian sumo wrestler, Karina Kolesnik, in blue and yellow. They both squatted down, face to face, and dug their fists into the sand. Her rival lunged forward, mushed Ishii in the face, but Ishii spun the wrestler around, flopping her on her back. Victory in 4 seconds. Then, after winning glory for Japan, Ishii returned to Tokyo to almost zero fanfare. Sumo is Japan's de facto national sport. And though other sports in Japan, even martial arts, are open to women, professional sumo is not. There are amateur sumo competitions for women, but all the money and attention goes into the professional league, governed by the Japan Sumo Association. It's like the NBA of sumo. They don't just prohibit women from competing. They won't even let women step in the ring. According to folk beliefs, that would make the sacred ring impure.
Menstruation.
Professor Suzuki Masataka says it has to do with menstruation. He's a professor of cultural anthropology at Keio University in Tokyo. He says many sumo fans believe women, because they have periods, bring terrible luck to the ring. 6 years ago, when a mayor in Kyoto Prefecture collapsed while giving a speech in a sumo ring, women from the crowd rushed in to deliver medical aid. And even then, the referee actually ordered the women out of the ring. Professor Suzuki says Japan's Sumo Association, even though it's a quasi-governmental organization, will never let women join. He says, I don't think they've ever really considered it. Even if Pro Sumo did invite women to compete, Suzuki doesn't think many people in Japan would watch it. But he does see one potential path to women's sumo gaining acceptance in Japan. He says, maybe the Japanese public will wake up to women's sumo if it thrives outside Japan first. And that is starting to happen.
I said, are you guys ready to see some sumo or what? Let's get it on!
The Rollertown Showdown Sumo Tournament was held in April in Dallas, Texas. Sumo is one of the hottest emerging sports in Texas and other parts of the U.S. Here's Texan sumo fanatic Sabrina Pacella.
It's such a test of balance and strength and agility that I can't find the words for it. It's just so fascinating.
Pacella hosts the podcast Sumo Punks with her partner, Matt Jim, a sumo wrestler himself. Go to a sumo event in America, Pacella says, and the crowd is gender diverse. More women are also jumping into U.S. dojos every day.
I don't know a single person in the entire U.S. sumo scene who wouldn't welcome more women into sumo.
Pacella is reluctant to criticize Japan's cultural norms, but as sumo grows more popular around the world, she's adamant that other countries accept women in the sport. Because if they don't, that would derail her dream. Women sumo at the Olympics.
Women in sumo in the Olympics, I would be ecstatic about that. I would be just over the moon.
Sumo is not yet in the Olympics. If it ever is, it'll have to have categories for men and women. Doesn't help that in Japan, the sumo heartland, women face such massive barriers to going pro. Back in Tokyo, Ishii Sakura and her team pound the dojo's walls with their fists, toughening up their hands. In sumo, you can't punch, but you can strike your opponent with your palm. Some serious sumo legends have emerged from this university dojo, going on to compete for big money and fame. Is there any chance that could happen for Ishii or any other Japanese woman?
In the near future, nothing like that would happen. Maybe in 10 years, 20 years' time, maybe that kind of path will open up for us too.
Ishii says when she graduates in a few years, her sumo career will end. So her mission is just to keep winning big at international tournaments.
If I win, it will give me more voice. And if I have that kind of fame, more people will listen to me.
In the time she has left in sumo, Ishii Sakura hopes to urge more Japanese women and girls to love a sport that doesn't always love them back. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Tokyo.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Japan today is one of the United States' most important allies. Rewind, though, to the mid-19th century. For more than 200 years, Japan had been largely isolated from the outside world. No one could leave, and foreigners were forbidden to enter. So imagine this. In 1848, a young man from the Pacific Northwest decides he's going to risk his life by breaking into this closed-off land on the other side of the world. Reporter Rebecca Rossman first told us about this history last winter.
His name is Ronald McDonald, or maybe it's Ranald McDonald, depending on who you ask. Either way, no, he doesn't bear any relation to that popular fast food franchise. I already asked. This McDonald was a bank clerk, born just over 200 years ago in present-day Oregon. When he was in his mid-20s, he somehow ended up here. This is a tiny, windy, volcanic island called Rishiri. It's located about 13 miles off the coast of Hokkaido, Japan's northern island. To get here, I had to take one of those tiny propeller planes from Sapporo, Hokkaido's largest city. It runs only once a day. My point is, getting here wasn't easy. But when this guy McDonald decided he wanted to sail to Rishiri from the U.S. back in 1848...
It would be like someone today deciding that they wanted to go to the moon.
That's author Frederick Schott.
He's written a 448-page biography of MacDonald.
There was no way for an ordinary individual to get to Japan.
It was the tail end of a 200-year period known as Sokoku, which literally translates to chained country. The government wanted to keep out any foreign influence, especially anything involving Christianity. Almost all foreigners were banned from entering Japan. Those who tried risked their lives. And yet this guy, MacDonald...
he just sails right in. The most amazing thing. It's not clear exactly what his goal was, and that's one of the fascinating things about his story. There are allusions to a secret plan that he might have had, but no one knows exactly what he wanted to do.
Born in 1824 to a Scottish fur trader and a Chinook mother, MacDonald grew up in a culturally rich environment, traveling across the U.S. and Canada. From a young age, he was also fascinated by Japan. Some say he was captivated by stories of shipwrecked sailors who described it as forbidden and unreachable. There's also speculation he felt he had a physical resemblance to the Japanese people, and that played a role in his motivation to get to Japan. So when he's in his mid-20s, he quits his day job as a bank clerk, becomes a sailor, and moves to Hawaii, where he meets these whalers who are planning a trip to the Far East.
His way of getting to Japan or getting close to Japan was to get there on a whaling ship, and that's really the only way you could do it.
MacDonald strikes a deal with the whalers. In exchange for his wages, he asks to be let off in the Sea of Japan and given his own boat with provisions. The captain agrees. They set sail in late June. They make it to the Sea of Japan a month later, and as promised, MacDonald is given a dinghy.
And he launched himself off the shores of Japan and wound up on Dishiri Island.
When locals found him here, he pretended his boat had capsized. Still, he was quickly arrested and interrogated, then detained in Nagasaki. But now here's the twist in the story. MacDonald ends up being no ordinary prisoner. Eiji Nishiya is a Japanese historian from Rishiri Island. He says when MacDonald was transferred to Nagasaki, people saw an opportunity in him. See, at the time, he says, there weren't really any English speakers in Japan. There were some Dutch translators. The Dutch had special rights to trade during the Sokoku period. But English, that was something else. And this was 1848, just a few years before Japan would start to open up again. Interpreters knew that English would be useful for them, too. So they taught MacDonald some Japanese. In turn, he became what many refer to as Japan's first English teacher. He taught English to some of the country's top interpreters, all while he was still detained by the Japanese government.
Enough English that it helped in the negotiations. In the initial negotiations with the United States Navy, with Commodore Perry, who arrived with this fleet of, you know, naval ships and forced Japan to open.
Commodore Matthew C. Perry is the U.S. Navy officer who sailed to Japan in 1853, effectively forcing an end to Japan's 220 years of isolationism through a series of negotiations. He's the man who gets all the credit anyway. But you could say MacDonald helped lay the groundwork for him. But MacDonald never really got to see the fruits of his labor. He was released from captivity in the spring of 1849 and almost immediately made his way back to the U.S. When he arrived back home, MacDonald sent a declaration to Congress about his time in Japan. Despite his detention, he spoke highly of his stay and said he had a lot of respect for the Japanese people. After that, he lived a relatively quiet life and fell into obscurity. His story becomes more or less forgotten in the history books.
He was really an example to me of a true transnational person. He doesn't fit into normal categories.
In other words, MacDonald was a true globalist. He didn't really represent one country or one story. And according to Schott, the history books don't really know what to do with these types of figures.
Most histories are national histories. Most histories that we're aware of are written in a national context. And that's one reason that he has been forgotten in many respects. And it's also one reason that he needs to be remembered.
There is one group leading that charge. Every summer since the late 1980s, members of the Friends of McDonald's Society have met in Oregon to celebrate McDonald's life. They also visit his gravesite in Washington State. Eiji Nishiya, the historian, is part of this group. Every year, he picks up a small stone from the spot in Rishiri where McDonald landed and brings it to his grave in Washington. He tells me to pick one up, too. McDonald spent only 9 months in Japan in total, but there's a reference to his stay on his tombstone. Here's what it says. Ronald McDonald, 1824 to 1894, son of Princess Raven and Archibald McDonald. His was a life of adventure, sailing the seven seas, wandering in far countries, but returning at last to rest in his homeland, sayonara. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman, Rishiri Island, Japan.
We hope you enjoyed this hour-long dive into Japan. Support for our reporting comes from the U.S.-Japan Foundation. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thanks, as always, for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Henry Becton, Richard Gingras, Betsy Gardella and Jim Smith, Rima Heider and Camilo Villa, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From PRX.